Two prominent philosophers, Dr. Craig, that you've interacted with, they've interacted with your work as well, are Michael Ruse and Gary Gutting. Talk about these two philosophers. I know that you've debated Michael Ruse and
referred to him quite a bit. Michael Ruse is a real character, philosopher of biology, ardently committed to evolutionary theory, neo-Darwinian evolution, but very appreciative of Christian philosophers and very open-minded about it. He's always a pleasure to dialogue with. I had a debate with him years ago in Canada that went very well, and then more recently participated in an intelligent design conference with him in Atlanta. And so we know each other and get on well. When we were at the Atlanta conference, we actually went out to dinner afterwards as a group, and he and I were seated across from each other, and we had a really interesting conversation on a personal level. He asked me, to my surprise, if I had achieved in life what I had hoped to achieve. And I didn't know quite how to answer that question. I said, well, I feel like things are going well. I'm doing all I can. I said, what about yourself? And he said, well, when I was a young philosopher, he said, I thought I could make a choice to either do really top quality work and throw myself into it, or to just sort of coast along. And he said, I thought of that line by Marlon Brando in On the Waterfront, I could have been a contender. And he said, I don't want to come to the end of my life and say with regret, I could have been a contender. So Bruce is driven by this vision to really try to be all that he can be as a philosopher and be a contender.
The reason that we're talking about these two philosophers is that Gary Gutting and Michael Ruse have a conversation in the New York Times. And Gutting actually interviews Michael Ruse, does evolution explain religious beliefs?
Now, I want to say straight away that that question that is the title is really a very minor part of this article. It is not about whether or not religious beliefs have an evolutionary explanation. That comes near the end, but there's a lot more in this very interesting and wide-ranging interview.
Dr. Gutting is at Notre Dame.
Yes.
Let's begin this interview then. Dr. Gutting says, what do you think of the claim that scientific accounts provide all the explanations needed to understand the existence and nature of the world, so that there's no need to posit God as the ultimate explanation? Dr. Ruse says, well, let me start at a more general level by saying that I don't think science as such can explain everything. Therefore, assuming that the existence and nature of the world can be fully understood, I'm not sure it can, this is going to require something more than science. As far as I'm concerned, if you want God to have a crack at the job, go right ahead.
Right. Yeah. So this shows his openness, I think, to theistic explanations, but also that he doesn't have the narrow blinders of scientism on. He recognizes that there are other sources of knowledge than simply what is delivered to us by the physical sciences.
Asked to elaborate, he says, in my view, none of our knowledge, including science, just tells it like it is. Knowledge, even the best scientific knowledge, interprets experience through human cultural understanding and experience, and above all, just as it is for poets and preachers, metaphor is the key to the whole enterprise. As I developed my own career path as a historian and philosopher of evolutionary biology, this insight grew and grew. Everything was metaphorical. Struggle for existence, natural selection, division of labor, genetic code, arms, races, and more.
Yes, isn't that fascinating that he sees metaphor as lying at the very heart of science? And this is so contrary to what scientistic types believe, that science gives us the literal truth about the way the world is. And what Ruse is saying is that science is permeated by metaphors that aren't to be interpreted in a literal way. And he gives some interesting examples here from his own field. things like the struggle for existence. That's clearly a metaphor. There aren't things in the world that are struggling for existence that is going on, or natural selection. Nature isn't selecting things. That's an agent-related process where you make a choice or a selection or division of labor, a genetic code, arms races between competing species and so forth. It really is interesting how much evolutionary biology is colored by these sort of metaphorical elements. Now, this is interesting as well to me because in my current work on God and abstract objects, the standard argument for Platonism today, that is to say, the view that things like mathematical objects, numbers, functions, and so forth actually exist, is that they appear in our best physical theories of the world. And since those theories are literally true, there must actually be things like numbers and functions and so on and so forth. And one of the responses to this argument is called figuralism, championed by Stephen Yablo, a prominent philosopher. And Yablo makes precisely this point, that it's impossible to separate the literal from the metaphorical in our scientific theories, and that therefore the appearance of things like mathematical entities in scientific theories doesn't imply that they literally exist. These could be part of the figurative speech of science. So it's very similar to the point that Roos is making here about metaphor.
Roos continues, since the scientific revolution, one metaphor, above all, the root metaphor, has dictated the nature and progress of science. This is the metaphor of the world as a machine, the mechanical metaphor. What questions are ruled out by this metaphor? One is about ultimate origins.
Yeah, he says that using this mechanical machine metaphor, you're not going to be able to answer the fundamental questions. And he mentions here Martin Heidegger's fundamental question of metaphysics, why is there something rather than nothing? So Roos recognizes that there are these sort of ultimate questions that can't be addressed when you're requiring mechanical sorts of explanations of everything.
This is so disturbing to so many people who listen to this because, Bill, they really cling to science, to a scientism. They really think that science is the only way to knowledge, yeah, or the most reliable way to knowledge. They imbue science with things that it does not have as a practice and as a methodology. Dr. Roos himself is saying this right here, and we've done podcasts on it, so I really hope that people will get it. It's not in any way a denigration of science. It's just putting science in its proper context, where it belongs, what it can and can't do.
Right. It's recognizing its limits, and within those limits, it's fantastic. It's a wonderful tool for understanding how the physical world operates, but as Roos says, it won't be able to answer ultimate questions.
Yeah, he says, I think it's a genuine question, why is there something rather than nothing, but not one answerable by modern science, quote unquote there. So Gutting asks, so you think that we need religion to answer the ultimate question of the world's origin? He says, if the person of faith wants to say that God created the world, I don't think you can deny this on scientific grounds. But you can go after the theist on other grounds. I would raise philosophical objections, for example, about the notion of a necessary being.
Okay, so that's, I think, very appropriate, and I appreciate this. He's saying that you can't go after the theistic hypothesis on scientific grounds. It's compatible with what science delivers to us about the world. You're going to need to raise philosophical objections. And he mentions one here, and he brings this up elsewhere in the interview, but he never explains what his misgivings are about the notion of a metaphysically necessary being. In fact, he'll point out later that Platonists say that abstract objects like numbers are metaphysically necessary in their existence. But he expresses here a philosophical misgiving about theism, namely the very concept of metaphysically necessary being. I would simply wonder what his misgivings are, since he doesn't explain them, and note that the vast majority of philosophers don't share such misgivings.
And he gets more specific, Bill. He says, I would also fault Christian theology. I don't think you can mesh the ancient Greek philosopher's notion of a God outside time and space with the Jewish notion of a God as a person.
Right. Now, I've dialogued with him about this before because this is my area of expertise, namely the relationship of God and time. And he's assuming here that Christian theology is committed to the idea of a God outside time and space. And I think that's simply not true. That's one possibility. But there are many Christian theists who would hold that God is everlasting throughout all time. As the psalmist says, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. And so it's a philosophical question that is an in-house argument among theists as to how to understand God's relationship to time. So if Roos is convinced that God as a person requires that God be temporal, there are a good many Christian philosophers who would be quite accommodating to that. Examples would be Nicholas Wolterstorff or Alan Paget, who would say that God is in time and is in infinite time, beginningless and endless time. On the other hand, I myself don't see any incompatibility between the notion of a God who transcends time and space and the idea of God as a personal being. And I've addressed this in my published work. For example, in the book Time and Eternity, there's a whole chapter devoted to arguments against divine timelessness, and one of these would be the idea that a timeless being cannot be personal. And in that chapter, I look at the typical arguments against the compatibility of timelessness and personhood, and I think they're all wanting. They either are predicated upon thinking that there are properties essential to personhood that really aren't, or else that a being which is timeless can't possess some of these properties. And again, I think you can show that that's false. So although Roos lays this out as one of his misgivings about Christian theology, I think it's both irrelevant and false. It's irrelevant because it's open to Christian theologians to say that God is in time, but it's false because I don't think there is any incompatibility between timelessness and personhood.
Dr. Gunning then asked him about Dawkins' notion that God would require at least as much explanation as the world in which God created. If there's complexity, well then what about the complexity of God?
Right, that's what Dawkins calls the central argument. Those are his words. Of the book, The God Delusion. And that is that if you say God designed the universe, then that raises the question, who designed the designer? Because God is just as complex an entity as the physical universe, and so would also require an explanation.
I know that you've interacted on that. We've done podcasts on it. But Michael Roos says, like every first-year undergraduate in philosophy, Dawkins thinks he can put the rest the causal argument for God's existence. If God caused the world, then what caused God? Of course, the great philosophers, Anselm and Aquinas particularly, are way ahead of him here. They know that the only way to stop the regression is by making God something that needs no cause. He must be a necessary being. This means that God is not part of the regular causal chain, but in some sense, orthogonal to it. He is what keeps the whole business going, past, present, and future, and it is the explanation of why there is something rather than nothing.
Right. Now, so the first response to Dawkins is to say that the argument is simply misconceived. It's like the undergraduate student who thinks he can easily refute theism. If God is a metaphysically necessary being, then there is no cause of God. Aristotle's concept of God was of a first uncaused cause. And this is the classic theistic concept of God, is that God is an eternal, metaphysically necessary, and uncaused being. Once you understand the concept of God, then you can see that the question is just completely out of order.
Roos goes on to say, and also God is totally simple. And I don't see why complexity should not arise out of this, just as it does in mathematics and science from very simple premises.
This is the point that I've made against Dawkins in my published work, is that God as a spiritual entity, a mind without a body, is a remarkably simple entity. That is to say, he's not composed of parts. The way Dawkins defines complexity in the book is something that is composed of physical parts. And of course, God isn't like that. When you think about a mind, a spiritual substance, it's not composed of anything. And so Roos says it's totally simple. And that is in contrast to the variegated universe with all of its fundamental constants and quantities that are inexplicable, that are just there. So positing God as an explanation for the complexity of the universe is definitely an advance in simplicity. The explanation is far simpler. I think what Dawkins has done is he's confused a mind's ideas with a mind itself. And certainly a mind can have complex ideas. It might be thinking of the infinitesimal calculus, for example. But the mind itself as an entity or as a substance is remarkably simple, being a spiritual entity not composed of parts. So Dawkins, I think, is just confused. He's confused a mind with a mind's ideas, and those are obviously not identical.
He says, traditionally, God's necessity is not logical necessity, but some kind of metaphysical necessity or aseity. Unlike Hume, I don't think this is a silly or incoherent idea any more than I think mathematical Platonism is silly or incoherent.
Now, this is a very interesting sentence. Remember, Roos said before that he has difficulty with the idea of a metaphysical necessary being. But here, he says, the idea of metaphysical necessity is not a silly idea or an incoherent idea. And he gives the analogy of mathematical Platonism. Platonists think that numbers and sets and other mathematical objects exist necessarily. It's not as though numbers just happen to exist in this world, but there's some other possible world in which 2 plus 2 doesn't equal 4, and there isn't 2 or there isn't 4. Numbers, if they exist, would be the sort of things that are metaphysically necessary in their being. And he says he doesn't see that there's anything incoherent or silly about mathematical Platonism, and then quite rightly says, I don't see anything silly or incoherent about God's being a metaphysically necessary being. So it makes you wonder exactly what his objection or misgivings are. He doesn't tell us.
No, he just says, I don't think it flies. The Christian God flies, but I really like this line here, Bill. He says, but I want to extend to Christians the courtesy of arguing against what they actually believe rather than begin and end with the polemical parody of what Dawkins calls the God delusion.
Yes, very good. That's right. Dawkins is not coming to grips with what Christian theologians actually hold to, but is attacking these caricatures.
We're going to continue this podcast next time, part two. But what is very interesting is that this is prominent in the pages of the New York Times. And so anyone who thinks that these are just upper shelf topics that not a lot of people are interested in, fascinating topics, and New York Times actually published this interview.
I would love it if this sort of debate came into the cognizance of the general public and wasn't just confined to philosophers.